This meeting of the House Resources Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:03 p.m. on Wednesday, April 15th, 2026, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Fields, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Elam, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Dibert, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Freer. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole from Records and Renzo Moises from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Excuse me. Before we get started, we are just joined by Representative Cologne. Before we get started, I'd like to reiterate that Co-Chair Dibert and I have extended the previously set amendment deadline for House Bill 381 by 1 week. The new amendment deadline for House Bill 381 in House Resources is this Friday, April 17 at 4:30 p.m. Today, and we've just been joined by Representative Prox also at 1:03 p.m. Today in House Resources, we have the Department of Revenue back before the committee to respond to committee comments and questions on House Bill 381. We have in the room Mr. Dan Stickle, Chief Economist for the Alaska Department of Revenue. Mr. Stickle, please come to the table, put yourself on record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. So the purpose of the slides today is to respond to some follow-ups from the presentation on March 25th. We've provided the committee with a response letter, and then also the answers are here in slide form. So four questions from the committee. We'll walk through each of those, and then there was one additional follow-up question that was provided by email after the hearing, and those questions are laid out on slide two. So slide three, the first question was, would an LNG import terminal be exempt from property taxes under this bill? So this bill exempts qualified property from property tax and many municipal taxes and fees. And we listed out the relevant bill language here on slide three. And on slide four, we stated what's in the current law. So the current law exempts an LNG export terminal from state law, and also certain elements of that LNG plants are exempt from current state law, but would be subject to municipal property tax. So slide five, to be a qualified property under the bill, an LNG plant would need to be part of the Alaska LNG project. So the full project that includes the gas treatment facility, the pipeline, and then the LNG export facility. A standalone LNG import facility would not be exempted under this bill. There is some question about whether an import terminal could potentially receive an exemption under this bill if it was part of the broader Alaska LNG project.
Your questions?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. This is our only presentation today, so you're welcome to ask questions through the presentation.
Thank you. Then through the chair, Mr. Stickle, question. So what are the how far, I guess the basic question I'll ask on behalf of the Fairbanks folks, is a spur line, is that, can you flip back one slide, please? No, I guess not. So, go forward, it was the question of if something is part of an LNG project, is a spur line a part of? How far does the part of extend?
Sure. Representative Sadler through the chair. So the LNG project consists of the gas treatment plant, the main trunk line for the pipeline, and then the LNG export facility. The Fairbanks spur line is currently not part of the Alaska LNG project. That would be a separate pipeline.
Okay. I got a bunch of questions, but I'll let that go for now.
Okay. Please proceed.
All right. So slide six was the next question we had. We were asked to provide a sensitivity matrix looking at cumulative local municipal revenues. Under the baseline and under the proposed legislation. So the top chart here shows each of the five municipalities that the proposed project would impact and what the property tax would be if this project went forward under current law. And we run a few sensitivities on capital expenditures. So our baseline capital expenditure assumption is about $46 billion in current dollars. And then we run sensitivities if there were to be higher capital expenditures for the project and what that would mean in terms of revenue to each of the municipalities. And then the bottom set of tables is a similar analysis, but under the proposed legislation, which exempts the project from property tax and replaces with the alternative volumetric tax.
Representative Fields?
Through the chair, I assume it would be pretty easy to convert this to some tables with annual income at certain volumes.
Representative Fields, through the chair, yes, we could, and we actually have a document that we'd be happy to provide that shows those annual incomes.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, please provide that to the committee and we'll get it distributed. Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Chair. Just a clarification, these columns represent the property tax income?
Representative Colomb, through the chair, so this is total local property tax income over the life of the project, and this would include the direct property taxes from the AKLNG project or the alternative volumetric tax, as well as any property taxes on associated additional oil development.
Okay, so the follow-up. So the baseline is the current law, proposed legislation. That's so just showing the difference, what they would get now as it is, and then to what the bill is suggesting.
Right, Representative Colomb, so the baseline is the counterfactual if the project went forward under current law, how much total revenue would flow to the municipalities over the life of project under a range of capital expenditure assumptions, and then the proposed legislation is with HB 381 enacted,
okay.
What that would look like.
All right, thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Stickle, on number six, looking at the spring baseline, I'm sorry, Fairbanks North Star Borough, $13. That's $13 over the life of the. Please help me understand. I can't believe that we're looking between $13 and $26.
Is this? Representative Sadler, through the chair. So, under the baseline modeling, Fairbanks North Slope Borough would receive $13 million over life of project from property taxes on the Alaska LNG project.
So if I may speak kind of generally, just back and forth. So are all these figures in millions of dollars or just that one column? In other words, North Slope Borough 10,727, is that 10,000 million?
Sure. Representative Sadler, through the chair, per the header, these are all in nominal millions of dollars over life of project. So
yeah.
North Slope Borough would be $10.7 billion over life of project, and under the current law scenario, and North Fairbanks North Star Borough would be $13 million.
Okay.
The reason the Fairbanks North Star Borough is relatively small is under the current project assumption, there's like 2 miles of pipeline that actually go through the Fairbanks Borough, so it would be a very small piece of the pipeline would be subject to local property tax.
Yeah, I'm simply making sure I understand the chart. And again, just for clarification for the record, Mr. Chair, so the base CapEx is, I think, is it $46.5 billion is what we're talking, and then 20, 40, 60 ahead of that, on top of that?
Sure. Representative Sadler, through the chair, so the base CapEx is $46.2 billion in real 2026 dollars. That's our baseline assumption.
Fair enough. And so, and one more follow-up.
Follow-up.
So looking at that first line, assuming the base CapEx, so the total municipal local revenues over the life of the project is $17.3 billion, and under the proposed legislation, it's $3.9 billion. So there's a pretty big delta there. Why, why would municipalities agree to this without any kind of compensatory? They're giving up a lot.
Sure. I'm Representative Sadler, and that's the policy question before you. You know, would the project go forward under current law? That's a big question. Our baseline assumption is that it would not. That's what went into the fiscal note. And so, you know, the argument there could be that some revenue is better than no revenue.
I have a question, Mr. Stickel, and this is a follow-up. I know my borough's mill rate. Can you tell me what the mill rate is for the other boroughs?
Sure. Representative Freer, through the chair, I have a table here that I will reference. This comes from Table 6-9 of the Fall Revenue Sources book. So as of 2025, 17.99 was the mill rate for North Slope Borough. 14.06 was the mill rate for Fairbanks North Star Borough. Denali Borough does not currently have a property tax. That's why there is zero under the current law scenario. Matsu Borough was 11.96 mill rate. Kenai Peninsula Borough was 8.97 as the mill rate. And again, those come from Table 6-9 of the Fall 2025 Revenue Sources book.
Thank you, Mr. Stickel. Are there further questions from committee members on this slide? Okay, please proceed.
All right, slide 7. We were asked to provide some analysis of the impacts of a potential state equity investment into the AKLNG project. So what slide 7 shows is the capital costs that would need to be outlaid by the state for a capital investment. Under our baseline capital assumption of the $46.2 billion, for a 5% equity share, the state would need to lay out about $885 million, and for a 25% equity share, the state would need to lay out about $4.4 billion.
Can I ask a question?
Representative Fields.
Going back to the previous slide.
Okay.
I apologize. Through the chair, I think, so the newspaper had reported that the property tax cut was 90%. These numbers are not, the ratio here is not 10 to 1. Could you explain the distinction between what had been reported in the newspaper and the numbers, which I think this is more like a 4 to 1 ratio?
Sure.
25% versus 10%. What's the difference?
Yeah, Representative Fields through the chair. So there's two things going on there. So the 6 cents per 1,000 cubic feet alternative volumetric tax is the equivalent of approximately a 90% reduction in total property tax liability compared to our baseline forecasting assumption.
Okay.
For this chart, there's two things going on. One, under the proposed legislation, we're including both revenue from the alternative volumetric tax to the municipalities. We're also including any incremental property tax revenue from new oil development. So we do anticipate additional investment in both Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, and then those would have property tax benefits to the North Slope Borough in particular.
Interesting. Okay.
The other piece is that we're listing out just the municipal impacts here on slide 6. Under current law, there is a split of the property tax for property within a borough between the state and the municipality. Under HB 381, for any property within a municipality, the municipality would get the entirety of the alternative volumetric tax. So the municipal revenues are a little bit more than the 10% for those two reasons.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Just, and it may be clear from the chart, but I have to ask Mr. Stickel. So if the proposed legislation at the bottom part of the chart on page 6 includes increase in the value of property tax for Prudhoe and Point Thompson, does the spring 2026 baseline chart, does that include current property tax on Prudhoe and Point Thompson?
Representative Sadler through the chair. So the spring 2026 baseline, that's not our spring 2026 revenue forecast. That's our spring 2026 gas line modeling. And so that does include this all the same assumptions except for the alternative volumetric tax.
I'm sorry. I did pop up. You said.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, ma'am. So you said in the baseline, Valley Borough has no tax, but in the proposed, there's a $92 million. Is there an assumption or plans for the Valley Borough to assess property taxes on this gas line project?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I would defer that question to the Denali Borough.
So what was the basis of including the $92 million in that column?
Sure. Representative Sadler, through the chair, so any under the proposed legislation, any property that goes through the borough would be required to levy the alternative volumetric tax on their portion of that. So the Denali Borough, under this legislation, would receive a portion of the revenue, even if they don't otherwise have a property tax.
Huh. Must they agree to that?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, so the way the bill currently reads is the municipality shall levy the tax on the portion of the project in their municipality, and then the state levies the tax on the portion of the project in the unorganized borough. So yeah. Denali Borough would, I mean, they would have to collect the revenue.
That's a yes.
Like it or not.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Cologne?
I'm good.
Representative, or Co-Chair Dibert.
Thank you, through the co-chair, to Mr. Stickel. Hopefully I could ask this in the right way, because I'm still trying to understand the volumetric tax. So I'm looking at Fairbanks North Star Borough and proposed legislation where it says $2 million. How long does it stay at $2 million, or when will we start getting more from the volumetric tax? Like, I don't know if that makes sense or if I'm saying it right. Thank you, Mr. Stickel.
Sure. Representative Dibert to the chair. So the volumetric tax would kick in once the project achieves the 1 billion cubic feet per day throughput level. And so that would be beginning in 2031 under our modeling. Once the project is at full capacity, which we assume is in 2033, at that point, the Fairbanks North Slope Borough would receive about $49,000 in the first full year based on their assumed share of the alternative volumetric tax.
May you please repeat that number?
It would be about $49,000 in the first full year, which would be 2033. And then that amount would increase by 1% annually thereafter.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've got Representative Elam in the queue.
Thank you. I kind of, you know, as I've looked through, I didn't want to, like, jump ahead of any of the slides here or anything, but I know that within the bill there's been some questions that I've been asked. I served in municipal stuff before I got here. There were some concerns about sales tax and being able to gather sales tax revenues. What's your take on what that is and how that looks within 381?
Sure, Representative Elam through the chair. So the bill has language that essentially the alternative volumetric tax would be in lieu of property tax or other taxes. I understand some concerns have been raised about the breadth of that exemption. The intent of the administration is to have a narrow exemption that essentially disallows a property tax on the project or a similar, you know, disallowing a property tax by another name. And so certainly open to potential language to tighten that up. Otherwise, we would address that through regulation.
Thank you.
Representative Fields, is this a follow-up to Representative Elam's question?
Yeah, for committee members who may not have looked at 2945 as such a broad exemption that if you worked on the pipeline, you could say you don't have to pay sales tax on your power drill when you buy it in the Matsu Valley, or you don't have to pay bed tax in Anchorage if you're staying in the hotel and working on the project. So yeah. I think, yeah, we probably need to remove that section, but it's easy fix. May.
Representative Elam?
Yeah, I actually have my office working on an amendment that would potentially do some of that, so I'll reach out.
Thank you.
So do I, Representative Ewing.
Okay.
Well, that was a concern that was actually brought up from the city of Soldotna, I believe, reached out and had that similar concern. So thank you.
Yep, thank you.
I've got Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see. Kind of a question that's jumping around. There is the initial 6 cents per 1,000 cubic feet. I'd like to know what that equals at various flow volumes, 1 million, 2 million, 250, 500, 750 million cubic feet per day. I just need to someone do the math for me carefully and get that back to me. And I guess, here's a question. What constitutes commercial operations of the phase one, just the pipeline?
Sure. Representative Sadler through the chair. That would be flowing gas for sale to consumers.
And no conditions on the volume, just initial sale of any molecule?
Representative Sadler through the chair, if there's a technical definition there, that might be something to call on a lifeline for. I don't know if Mr. Kissinger's online or else we can get that back to the committee in writing.
Thank you. Actually, we do have also on the line available for questions. We have Matt Kissinger, Commercial Director for AGDC, David Herbert, Commercial Analyst for Department of Revenue, and Ryan Farnsworth, the Assistant Attorney General for Legislation, Regulations, and Legal Research Section from the Department of Law.
I want to kind of retract. I know we have a lot of presentation. I got many questions about this bill. I don't wish to detract from the presentation, so I'll hold my questions or my grab bag of questions later. Thank you for your consideration.
Perfect. Thank you. Representative Fields.
Oh, no, I was waiting to.
Oh, okay. Perfect. Well, then we can proceed with the presentation.
All right. So we'd been on slide 7 before we rolled back, and slide 7 laid out the potential state capital costs associated with an equity investment in the project at either a 5 or a 25% state equity share. These assume a 70-30 debt-to-equity structure, same as other investors. So the state investment would be leveraging additional debt investment as well. And then slide 8 is the flip side of that, showing state revenues from an equity investment. We're showing this at the 5% ownership level, what the total cumulative cash flow back to the state from that 5% equity share would be over life of project. So in the first set of tables, we have the baseline, which is under the assuming the project were to go forward under current law. Over life of project, the state receives the $29.7 billion of cash flow from all of the existing revenue sources, and then an incremental $4.36 billion of equity revenues back from the project. And that would be what the state receives in return for its $885 million capital investment. Again, these are in nominal terms. Under the proposed bill, the state would receive over life of project $22.5 billion of total revenues from the alternative volumetric tax and all the other tax and royalty streams. And then the state would receive $4.2 billion of revenue from its equity share, which is the return on the $885 million investment. And we include the shares to all of the other stakeholders as well under both scenarios here. To note, the upstream and midstream owners, those represent cash flows, not profits. And so the cost of operation of both the upstream and midstream, as well as any profits, would be paid out of those cash flows.
Representative Sadler?
Madam Chair, I confess that these are some economic terms that I do not have a lot of facility with. I wonder if Mr. Stickler would repeat that. State SQ revenues. What's SQ stand for first?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that represents state status quo. That would be our existing suite of revenue sources of royalty, production tax, property tax, or alternative tax and corporate tax.
So I could understand that if that was part of the baseline, which I kind of assume is the status quo, no change in the law. But under the proposed legislation, there is status quo revenues. Is that just there to point a little bit harder at the difference? I'm not sure why that's included in the proposed legislation chart.
Sure. Representative Sadler, through the chair, the point here of breaking out the state revenues was that this chart shows what the total project cash flows would be if the state took a 5% ownership share. Mm-hmm. And so we break out the revenues directly related to that ownership share, which is the second column of the $4.4 or $4.2 billion. We break those out from all other state revenues to distinguish.
Okay, is this a follow-up to Representative Sather?
It's just on the slide.
Okay. Well, then I've got Representative Mears, unless, well, Representative Sather, we can come back to you.
Thank you, through the chair. So equity investments is not the bill before us, but something that we need to start turning our brains on. So I don't think it's too premature to start thinking about that. This is based on the inflation-adjusted amount of about $46 billion. If the feed, so the cost estimate that the project is utilizing, says, hey, we've got final investment decision, the feed is 20% higher, do these numbers roughly go up about 20% higher for what our investment is and potential income from that investment?
Representative Mears, through the chair, yes. Once we take an ownership share, we would be sharing in the cost overruns or potentially different cost levels.
The follow-up? That kind of gets to my second part. So one is if the actual feed is higher, but also like what happens with cost overruns, because cost overruns aren't going to be realized until project completion. And so like having information at the beginning of the project and knowing what we would be responsible for if that project ends up higher over time, I think is an important consideration. So if we take a 5% ownership and the costs do go up, does then our requirement for participation automatically go up as well, or does that kind of depend on how we write the contract?
Representative Mears, through the chair, you know, I'm sure potentially there's ways that we could write a contract to protect the state in some ways. But as a general rule, the investors bear the risk of any cost overruns, and if the state chooses to be an investor, then we would share in that risk.
Thank you.
And can I just ask, did you say $885 million or $889?
Sure, Chair Freer. So those, going back to slide 7, I was referencing the nominal value of the state equity of about $885 million.
So a potential 20% increase would take it to a little over a billion if the state chose to invest?
Representative Chair Freer, correct.
Okay, thank you.
All of these numbers would scale.
Okay. Representative Sather.
Thank you. I got more questions on it, but I want to go back to slide 7 for a second. We're breaking out 5% state equity. Must the state invest 5% equity in basically a market basket of all three aspects of both phases? Or may the state take 5% in GTP capital, that is the CCUS and the North Slope. The state may otherwise take 5% equity in pipeline, and the state may take 5% equity in LNG plant. Is that correct, or is it all bound together?
Sure. Representative Sather, through the chair, so my understanding is that the state may invest in the three components separately at separate levels, but for an investment, it needs to be at least 5%. For each individual level. And Matt Kissinger, if you want more details on exactly how that would work, he's the expert.
Yeah, this is some of the guts of the issue the state has to consider, so we have to make sure we understand this thoroughly. If I may follow up?
Follow up.
Okay, thank you. Turning to slide 8, you made a point, Mr. Sickle, of saying this is, I think you said this is not revenue, this is cash flows, or I want to understand the differentiation between revenues and cash flows. This is not annual cash flow. Please explain what you mean by the differentiation between cash flows and revenues.
Sure. Representative Sather, so this is total revenue to the project, all of the money that comes in from selling the gas, and where does that revenue go? For the state, federal, municipal, and upstream, those revenues those become revenues to the government. State, federal, and municipal. For the upstream owners, they would have to pay their cost of operations out of those revenues. So their capital costs, their costs of their operating costs of producing the gas and associated oil would be paid out of that $60.4 billion of revenue. And then for the midstream as well, those costs would have to recover their capital costs, their operating costs, any profit that the midstream owner makes.
And do a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so the upstream owners would represent who, just kind of for the public and kind of also for me?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, so the upstream owners would be the producers of the gas. The primary producers are Hillcorp, Exxon, ConocoPhillips, also potentially other operators on the slope.
And so we'll note that under the model here, they would make the same amount of money under the baseline versus the AVT. So that's why it's the same, okay? And the notes at the bottom of the chart say midstream owners column excludes state equity revenues. Can you please explain that?
Sure, Representative Sadler through the chair. So typically when we show this this sort of chart, the midstream owner is Glenfarn and their related investors. What we've done here is if the state takes a 5% ownership share, then 5% of the cash flows from the project operations would become those state equity revenues, and Glenfarn and their associated investors would retain the remaining 95% of those cash flows. And so we've basically taken the total midstream profit and we've broken it out 5% to the state as the state equity revenues and then 95% to the remaining midstream owners.
Gotcha. So this assumes state 5% in the entire project?
That's correct, Representative Sadler, through the chair.
Thank you. And Representative Fields joined us back, so we'll go back up the queue to Representative Fields.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Sickle, so when ConocoPhillips reports on oil taxes, we can see how much does Conoco pay in oil taxes, how much do they earn in profits. It's kind of one-to-one for oil. Do you know, from looking around the world, what is kind of a reasonable range of government share of revenue for large LNG projects, given the different economics of gas, so that we could assess, are we earning a fair share of gas revenue compared to profits obtained by gas companies? Looking here, midstream plus upstream, 125,000 you roll in the equity share, another 130,000 in revenue compared to state revenue of 22, which is maybe 1/10. It's a pretty different ratio in terms of revenue compared to profit. Some context, I think, would be helpful in terms of what's a reasonable ratio to look for based on other large projects and revenue collection around the world. Through the chair.
Sure. Representative Fields through the chair. And as far as that question goes, that would be an excellent question to pose to the consultants. I know Gaffney Klein has done some work on that.
Okay.
Looking at midstream, generally, we heard testimony in the other body that a 10 to 12% internal rate of 10 to 12% return for midstream owners is a fairly standard benchmark for a project with good contracts in place. Looking at upstream, typically looking at 15% plus is kind of a floor for a level of return that an upstream owner would be looking at for a major project investment.
Madam Chair, could we ask Gaffney Klein to follow up on that? So if we accept these numbers, is this a reasonable rate of state share relative to other large gas projects around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. We can follow up with Gaffney Klein.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We're about halfway through the presentation. We're on slide 8 of 18, so that's why I'm allowing a lot of leeway with questions rather than going through and asking them at the end. So Representative Colom is next in the queue.
Thank you, Chair. Let me think. It's a while ago. Oh, I know what I was going to ask. The 5% ownership, this talks about the state. Are boroughs allowed to have equity investments in the pipeline?
Representative
is it only offered to the state?
Yeah, Representative Colom through the chair. So as I understand it, the boroughs could invest via the state's option to invest. And again, that would be a Matt Kissinger could provide additional detail on that if needed.
Mr. Kissinger, did you hear the question?
Hi, yes, this is Matt Kissinger for the record, and Representative Colomb through the chair. ADDC and any of the state-owned entities would have the direct right, and so I think there'd be a question, actually a legal question, about whether the municipalities or the boroughs would fall under that definition. I suspect not. I've actually thrown this in the chat GPT before and gotten the answer that no, they wouldn't be able to, but they would be able to through a vehicle that we could set up as a subsidiary of AGDC. So there are ways to make it happen, if not directly, then indirectly.
Is the Department of Law on there?
We do have the Department of Law on the line. Mr. Farnsworth, do you want to take a stab at that question?
This bill wouldn't prevent it, is all I can say.
Can I follow up? Follow up? Okay, so this bill would not prevent what?
It doesn't prevent munis from taking an ownership. It just is silent about that.
Oh, okay. And so would you agree with the comments before that it would have to be a vehicle through AGDC, or could a borough or municipality set that up themselves?
I don't know. I'd have to look into that.
Yeah, Mr. Farnsworth, thank you. If you could follow up with the committee via email, and we can distribute that.
I did have another question whenever.
Representative Colomb, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Stickle, on slide 8, how come there is a decrement in federal revenues in the 2042 lines in both charts?
Sure, Representative Colomb through the chair. So we assume two impacts on federal revenues during the initial 10 years of production of the project. One is that there is a offset to federal income taxes during the investment phase, as companies are laying out capital and reducing federal taxable income. The other is that we assume that the project will qualify for 40 tax credits under the Federal Tax Code Section 45Q, which is a credit for carbon sequestration, and that some of the carbon at the gas treatment plant would actually be sequestered and qualify for those federal tax credits.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm taking notes. I've got Representative Mears next.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm grateful Mr. Kissinger is on the line, so he can add some additional context or correct anything for some context I'm about to set. So I think it's clear that there's more background that the legislature needs, because we're right now talking about investment, and we're not talking about the bill that's in front of us regarding the property taxes. But since we are on potential investment, I wanted to remind folks that, if I'm remembering correctly, there's three different subsidiary companies that the state has individual options of equity stakes in. It's all midstream, but on the northern end is the gas treatment and carbon storage unit. There's the pipeline itself, and then there's the liquefaction plant down in Nikiski. So what we're looking at here on slide 8, and I believe slide 9 is a 25% example, is for the entirety of the project. So there's more that we're going to need to get into about the different phases, about the different components of the project. Additionally, there's two phases of the project. The first phase of the project is only the pipeline, which does not include compressor stations. I just sent the statute book over to Representative Sadler that the compressor stations will be part of the pipeline when that's done. So that even the pipeline itself has got a couple of phases of what's included in that. And phase two, the way things are, we've been discussing things, phase two happens when the gas treatment plant the liquefaction happens down on the south end of the project. So there's a lot of pieces here, and just reminding us of that context and where we're at in the process. I'd pitched it to Mr. Kissinger if there was any additional context he wanted to provide.
Thank you, Mr. Kissinger.
Representative Mears, through the chair. I think that you described it really well. The more time that if we need to spend more time and walk through this, more than happy to, but that's exactly right. These decisions that Mr. Stickle is showing, he's showing a combination of many decisions. As you mentioned, the phase one decision on the pipeline, and then when we hit phase two, multiple decisions on the GTP, on the pipeline, and on the LNG facility. Every time capital is raised for the project is the way to think about it. Every time capital is raised for the project, we have a right to preempt 25% of that raise. And there will be multiple rounds of capital raising as we build out the project.
Follow up to Mr. Kissinger. I'd also like to use this as a point of illustration, is that the legislature is very interested in having a lot more information about that, and it's bleeding into our conversation about House Bill 381, and we need to make sure that that is being presented to us distinctly as well. Thank you.
Representative Mears, to the chair, let me take that back and figure out a best way to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Kissinger. Representative Sadler.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Important question. I understand that the alternative volumetric tax will kick in and begin to provide revenue to municipalities once we reach the 1 billion cubic feet per day threshold. What happens if this pipeline chugs along just short of that 1 billion threshold at 950? Does that mean no tax is generated and distributed to the state or to the municipalities?
Sure. Representative Sadler, to the chair. So the tax would kick in at the conclusion of a ramp-up period. The ramp-up period would be 10 years or the $1 billion threshold. So if we were at that just under $1 billion, then after 10 years, the alternative tax would kick in.
So to put a point in this, so if by any chance the volume did not exceed $1 billion, there would be no tax flowing from this for a decade. Is that correct?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, there would be no alternative volumetric tax or property tax on the project for a decade, correct?
And to put a finer point, too, so the baseline status quo anti-property tax would also not be collected. So municipalities could end up with zero property tax on this for a decade minus a day. That's absurd.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
I did have a question, actually.
I do have you in the queue, but if yours is a follow-up to Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Everett.
Thank you, through the co-chair, to Mr. Stickle. To follow up to that question from Representative Sadler, I don't know a lot about the flow and volumetric flow of gas through a pipeline. How long does it take other pipelines across the world take to get to a billion per day of cubic feet produced flowing through a pipeline? What is the usual timeline? Thank you.
Sure. Co-Chair Dibert, so it's going to be project specific. And again, that's a kind of the comparison to different projects around the world is a great question for the consultants. What the billion cubic feet per day represents is it represents when the full export project is online. So the expectation is there would be initial in-state sales, which would be well under that billion cubic feet per day threshold, and then potentially three trains of LNG, and each train would be contributing over a billion cubic feet a day. So once a train of LNG comes online, that following month we would expect to see the alternative tax kick in.
Thank you, Mr. Sickle. Representative Fields.
I'm going to first try to answer Co-Chair Dibert's question. So lower volumes flow at a slower pace, higher volumes flow at a higher pace. So if you didn't have a lot of export customers, you could have a relatively low daily volume of gas that nonetheless filled the pipeline. So the pipe is essentially a storage facility and pipeline flowing at a slower pace, which is different than an oil pipeline And Nick Fulford could explain this in greater detail at a subsequent committee hearing, but it's not like the pipeline is one-tenth full. Now it's full, moving more slowly at lower rates of production. I was curious through the chair, either to Matt Kissinger or Dan Stickle, how lucrative or meaningful are those 45Q tax credits in the context of other revenues from the project?
Sure. Representative Fields to the chair, I believe I have a lifeline that can give you some values on what those 45Q credits add up to. I don't have those at my fingertips. They are material benefit to the project.
Representative Fields to the chair, if I'm not on mute. We have those. Actually, they're very similar, in fact, to the property tax impact from our understanding. So 7.5 million tons of CO2 per year would be sequestered, and that would be at a rate of $85 per ton with some inflation adjustments. I believe that comes out to right around $500 million per year. So it's roughly the same as the property tax, slightly less impactful.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And then I think we're going to do one final question before proceeding with the presentation. Representative Sadler.
Boy. Well, I guess Mr. Stickle, I'll ask you to guard against the situation I just described, that there might be, at whatever degree of ramp up of production, if it's still short of a billion, no AVT is generated. So could you model for me? The question Representative Field asked, what does the fair government take? I'm concerned that there's no government take until we reach that threshold. So what would the impact on the project economics if there were to be a ramp-up of the AVT at different tranches short of 1 billion cubic feet of gas per day? Understanding, of course, that when you open up the pipeline, you open up the wells, the gas flows. It's not necessarily a slow. It's probably not much until there's a lot. But my question stands, what's the economic effect of ramping up the tax over a gradual slope?
Sure, Representative Sadler, we'd be happy to, through the chair, we'd be happy to model any alternatives the committee would like to see.
Then I'll ask for at the same 100, 200, 250, 500, 750 million cubic feet per day.
All right, and Representative Sadler, through the chair, under our baseline modeling, potentially those would just have the tax kicking in a year or two earlier than currently modeled.
I'm sorry to understand. Baseline status quo without the tax bill? What do you mean?
Representative Sadler through the chair. So currently we have the alternative volumetric tax threshold. We have production starting in 2029 as our baseline assumption, which would be for in-state sales. And then we have the billion cubic feet per day threshold being reached in 2031.
Maybe.
And good. So potentially under those scenarios, you could see the tax beginning in either 2029 or 2030. And so that's what the supplemental analysis will show.
But if it reaches that 1 billion cubic feet per day, right? Or maybe I'm missing something essential here.
Maybe I can help. So the baseline is current law.
Chair Freer, so there's two baselines here. apologies for the confusion. So we have a baseline that represents current law, a current law baseline, and then we have a kind of a baseline set of assumptions around the project.
Okay.
And those assumptions around the project include in-state sales beginning in 2029, and the billion cubic feet per day threshold and full export beginning in 2031 with the first train, second train in 2032, and then third train in full project capacity in 2033. And so under those assumptions and HB 381 as written, we model that 2031 would be the first year that we would receive revenue from the alternative volumetric tax, because that's when the billion cubic feet per day threshold is reached. If the billion cubic feet per day threshold were reduced to a lower threshold, then if it were reduced enough, then potentially the tax could kick in during the in-state only phase, which would be 2029 or 2030.
And I guess I have to ask a dumb question, but there are no dumb questions, if I may. So will alternative volumetric tax be collected upon the commencement of in-state sales, which you estimate to be 2029? Will there be tax paid to municipalities in the state?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, there would not be alternative volumetric tax paid. Potentially municipalities could be receiving incremental property tax from associated developments, which would be increased investment in the upstream.
So my concern is this leaves a window, a situation in which if we were falling below that billion, that municipalities could be, and the state could be, foregoing its property tax for up to a decade, maybe longer, entirely.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Sadler. I think we can go ahead and proceed with the presentation. I think slide 9 is very similar to slide 8, minus the 5 to 25%, so I don't know how much we want to, but please proceed.
Yeah, it is indeed. So slide 9 is a 25% ownership share, and you'll notice that the state equity revenues should be almost exactly 5 times what we showed on slide 8 for the 5% ownership share. And then again, a reduction in the midstream owner share because we are taking 25% ownership to the state and retaining 75% for the developer and their investors. Slide 10 is a chart showing these outlays over time under the 5% equity scenario. So you see a period of time where we are investing significant revenues in the development of the project, and then a period of time where we are receiving revenues from the project. Those are offset by payments on debt to secure those revenues, and then we assume a 20-year time horizon for those debt payments, and then over the last decade of the project, we're receiving significantly more revenues from our equity investment. And just to clarify, there was a comment in the other committee about what the dashed line represents. So the dashed line corresponds to the right-hand scale on this chart, and that represents the total volume of gas sold from the project each year, while all of the revenue bars correspond to the left-hand side of the chart and show revenue in millions.
Representative Fields?
Through the chair, are the multiple years of negative cash flow a result of paying for debt service before there's any offsetting revenue?
Representative Fields, to the chair. So those multiple years of negative revenues would primarily be for the cash outlay of the equity investment.
I see. I have a different question after other people.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'm going to turn the question. The question I've been wanting to ask for a while, and maybe I'll ask a few times before I understand it. What modeling does revenue have that shows us that the 2 mil rate, I guess it's the six cents per MCF, is the best rate for this project? How do we know that we're not leaving money on the table? How do we know whether the more effective rate might not be 1 mil or 5 mils? Can you show me the chart that demonstrates the calculation of why 2 mils has been deemed to be an appropriate number?
Sure. Representative Sadler, through the chair. So we don't have modeling to show that that's the perfect tax rate, and that's not something that we would be able to opine on with certainty. I can point to a benchmarking exercise that's been done by AGDC, and that was the source of the proposed roughly 2 mils equivalent alternative volumetric tax. And that benchmark exercise shows that that's roughly equivalent to what is done in other jurisdictions. And Mr. Kissinger would be happy to opine more if that's helpful.
Please.
Mr. Kissinger, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. Through the chair, Matt Kissinger, for the record, Representative Sadler, through the chair, Mr. Stickle has it exactly right. So we brought in Gas Strategies. It's a firm out of London. They do energy intelligence, and when we went through our economic stage gate and property tax stood out as one of the key things that we should try and address, we brought them in to do this benchmarking, looking across at different jurisdictions within the U.S., North America, and even overseas. And as Mr. Sickle says, the outcome of that study was that in Alaska, for this project, we would be paying a sort of whole order of magnitude more than those places. So, you know, 10 times as much as the next highest, which was around $50 million a year versus our over $500 million. And that is really where that original adjustment from 20 mil to 2 mil came from in the AGDC assumptions on how to move the project forward.
Follow up.
Thank you. Mr. Kistner, you lost me yet. The study showed that we'd be paying more. I've lost you. Please give me the parameters of that. Who'd be paying what for whom? Please explain that again. You said the benchmark study showed
what
that.
The study found, Representative Sadler through the chair, what the study found was that in all the other jurisdictions, our competing projects that are in those jurisdictions are paying roughly one-tenth in property tax compared to what we would be paying in Alaska under the current statutes.
So the property tax rate in those other projects is a lot lower?
It's incredibly lower, yeah. We are around 10 times larger or higher than them.
So the decision was made just in reference. Again, my question still stands. How do we know that 5 isn't the right number? Or do we just copy?
Representative Sadler to the chair, what we're trying to do is ensure there is sufficient room within the project economics to achieve a positive FID. And when we looked at the project during the economic stage gate, several things stood out as hampering that. One of them was needing the loan guarantees in place. They were originally written for a pipeline to North America. That's somewhat key. Another aspect was achieving project finance. That is really the main difference from when we went from producer-led onto the current model. But then property taxes also stood out. And so the idea was, what are our competitors paying in these other jurisdictions? And if we were paying the same amount as they are paying in property taxes, how would that position the project? And the view was that positions the project much more favorably to achieving an FID and allowing the developer to be able to absorb the cost overrun risk.
Thank you. Representative Fields, then Representative Klom.
Through the chair, it looks like slide 10 and subsequent revenue slides are based on $1 billion throughput, and I was just hoping that DOR, or sorry, a BCF of throughput, and I was just hoping that DOR could supply us with other scenarios, say, you know, what are the revenues that an in-state throughput of 200 MCF or 2 billion or 2 BCF. So just seeing those different scenarios since we don't actually know what the throughput will be. Thank you.
Thank you. And if I could add on to that, if we can see modeling at different mill rates. So rather than the 2% at the 6 cents, but maybe like what Representative Sather was referring to, a 5 mil or 10 mils.
Sure, and just to follow up on that, through the chair to Representative Fields, so I do have some information on slide 11 and then in a subsequent slide that show revenues on an annual basis as throughput in the project increases. When we are looking, so the roughly a little over a billion cubic feet of total throughput per year is the 3.5 billion cubic feet per day, which is the maximum project capacity. If we are looking to model different levels of throughput, that would be a fundamentally different project. So we would want to work with the committee to define exactly what that request looks like. So if you were to have a project that would have 500 billion cubic feet per year of throughput, we would want to also scale down the capital cost and update other assumptions as well. So it's not as simple as just ramping everything up or down. But we'd be happy to work with the committee on that.
Representative Fields?
Through the chair, to clarify, I'm just not assuming that even if the project moves forward, it necessarily reaches that volume throughput, and I just want to understand what the different scenarios are. We could have a project that's primarily in state, and I want to see those in front of us, please.
Sure. And Representative Fields, through the chair, that specific scenario of an in-state-only pipeline where the first phase happens and the additional phases do not, that is an analysis that we are working on, and okay. We'll be happy to provide that specific analysis to the committee.
And if I could just clarify, same pipe, just if we don't achieve an export volume. Thanks.
Yes. We will provide that.
Thank you. Representative Colom.
Thank you, Chair. Two questions. One, so I'm 10, right? Okay, yeah, slide 10. I was kind of, so your chart, the revenue isn't really exact. I was kind of trying to count the lines. Do you know, so if we do this 5% ownership, which was $885 million, I think, how many years would it take for us to get our investment back?
Sure, Representative Colom, through the chair. So it's within the first decade of full production, which is what you see on slide 8, that we have a cumulative net positive of $360 or $367 million through 2042. So it is within that that first decade of full production, and we'd be happy to give an exact date of that break-even date.
Follow up? Okay, so that's 10 years once it's producing, but we would have 5 years before that, too. We'd be waiting. It would take about 15 years then to get it back.
Representative Colom, to the chair, so mental math, which I shouldn't be doing, but I am, it would be roughly between the 8th and 9th year, so we're looking at the 2038 to 2039,
okay.
2040, around that time frame, so...
Okay, and one more question. So around that, so 2038, then 2040, 2042, all the blue lines, revenue lines go down. Why is that?
Sure, Representative Clem to the chair. So I believe it has to do with some of the specifics of the financing and the debt issuance. I may call on a lifeline to present that exact explanation of the drop in 2042.
Okay. Matt?
To be Mr. Herbert.
Yeah. Mr. Herbert, yeah. Did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. So through the chair, specific to the drop in state equity revenues we're seeing starting 2040 and going to 2050, the primary cause of that is the 45Q credits are scheduled to only last 12 years, and that's the point where those credits would no longer be a revenue stream for the project under our current assumptions. The ramp up we're seeing on 2050 onwards is where some of our debt financing terms are no longer providing a negative cash flow to the project. Under this set of assumptions.
Okay.
Does that mean...
A follow-up?
When our debt financing... does that mean when we're paid off our loans, our obligations, is that what you mean?
Through the chair, yes. And again, for the record, David Herbert, Department of Revenue.
Thank you, yeah. Some of the economic terms may be nominally correct, but boy, they're hard to understand and apply real world.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. And I think this sort of demonstrates that we are kind of jumping around with questions and understanding here. I didn't want to get too far away from Representative Sadler was going in his previous set of questions around to Mr. Kissinger. So what we're looking at here with House Bill 381 is a tool to reduce something that the state has control over as far as project economics go. So the project, one of the tools that we have to reduce income to the state to make the economics of the project more attractive, which I believe Mr. Fulford from Gaffney Klein said is skinny, is to reduce this income to municipalities. So this is just one tool. What we still don't have is what those larger project economics are, what other state income is, what it looks like on the upstream for royalties, what it looks like are Does the state only have the ability to get income from a strong market if we buy into the project, or are there other places? So I think there's some larger project economics that House Bill 381 doesn't deal with. We are just looking at a tool and one of the things going on here.
Thank you, Representative Mears. Co-Chair Dybert.
Thank you, through the co-chair, to Mr. Stickel. Two questions. Looking at this graph, so phase one will be done roughly around 2029. When will phase two be complete on this graph, if we were? And then my second question is, how much does, I might have missed it, it's a lot of information, sorry, co-chair, how much does Alaska need a day or year of cubic feet of natural gas?
Sure.
Specifically for phase one for domestic consumption.
Sure. Co-chair Dybert. So phase one, which comes online in 2029 in our modeling, we're assuming that that's about 65 billion cubic feet per year. Current South Central demand is between 65 and 70 billion cubic feet per year. So we're assuming that initially there would be essentially a baseload customer, most likely, where there would be a baseload industrial customer, and then a portion of the residential and utility demand would be met by phase one, and then over time a growing share of there would be additional in-state demand and a growing share of utility and residential demand met by the pipeline for in-state use. And then the full phase two is initially comes online in 2031 with the first train, a second train in 2032, and then the third train and full project maximum capacity of the 3.5 billion cubic feet per day in 2033.
Thank you so much.
All right. Please proceed with the, is this on this slide?
Well, no, but we cannot help but jump around. I'm sorry, I want to make sure you get Bullock's in. So I'd like to pose a question and ask for Mr. Stickel. There's the bill includes a 1% annual increase in the alternative volumetric tax. I'd like to see that modeled as to what the take would be, what the revenue generated would be at other levels. I just picking out of my ear 1.1%, 1.5%, 1.75%. Just give me some idea. That's another number. I'm not sure why, other than being a great cardinal number, one, that's the appropriate number. So I assume you can plug those into a model someplace and show me what that would generate for the escalator.
Sure, Representative Sadler, through the chair. We'd be happy to provide some alternatives there.
I would love to. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Okay. Mr. Stickel, thank you.
All right. So slide 11 is going to look like a familiar slide. This is the 5% ownership, just zoomed in on the 2026 through 2035 time frame. And the reason we showed this kind of zoomed in time frame is to show the initial outlay of cash each year for the state ownership. And so it would be, approaching a little, just under $200 million per year of investment that the state would be required to make in 2027, 2028, and 2029. And then positive revenues from the state investment would start accruing beginning in 2031. And then it would be a positive return to the state from that point onward.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Jump. Again, the time we have available, we talk a lot about the fiscal notes being reflect the cost of legislation of the state of Alaska, and often lament that the fiscal notes do not reflect the benefit or detriment to the entire economy. Do you, Mr. Economist, sir, have any information as to what the impact would be on the state economy as a whole of this project? The state is proposing to give up significant property tax revenue for the benefit, which I support, of getting the gas pipeline going. But any information you might have on the secondary and tertiary effects on the state's economy would be very welcome.
Sure, Representative Sadler, through the chair. So the fiscal note itself that we provided is very narrow, and it reflects just the state's share of just the alternative volumetric tax just for the first 2 years of in-state or the first 2 years of operation. And so what we've done is we've provided an additional supplemental analysis that provides more detailed analysis on all of the revenues to the state from all of the different sources. And then, obviously there are benefits above and beyond just revenue. We have not attempted to quantify those exactly. We can speak to them qualitatively. So those would be things like security of energy and a secure low-cost source of energy for interior South Central Alaska, lower energy costs across the state through the Affordable Energy Fund and indirectly through power cost equalization, increased competitiveness for additional North Slope investments. And that's a significant aspect of the project, where right now if a company goes out and explores for oil and gas on the North Slope, if they find a gas field, that's not worth anything to them. But with a market for gas through a gas pipeline or another market, finding a potential development that is a gas field or a combination of oil and gas, now that has a market, and that's more valuable and makes exploration more attractive. And then obviously increased employment and economic multiplier effects of both the direct employment as well as the indirect employment through construction, things like that.
Follow up.
I'm looking for, I support the project, want to make it happen, want to be able to make the sale. I would just observe that if the pipeline's entire capacity is locked up for 20, 30 years, the incentive for new gas exploration is not going to hit until year 25, 6, 7. So if you're not going to invest now if you're not going to have a market for that gas for 25 years. Is that a fair statement?
Representative Sadler, through the chair.
Can't sell it.
Maybe. It would depend on exactly how the contracts are structured. If there is an opportunity for, another gas seller to come in midway through the project, or would we wait until we assume that Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk will anchor the project? That would be something that would have to be worked out with the gas sales agreements.
If I may, and compressibility, additional compression stations, is 3.5 billion cubic feet a day the absolute engineering capacity? Can we squeeze more gas in with more compression after that or not?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I'll defer that to Mr. Kissinger.
Mr. Kissinger?
Yeah, this is Matt Kissinger for the record. Representative Sadler, through the chair. We actually have a study where you can put a whole another almost 1 billion standard cubic feet a day through with just added compression. Pipelines are interestingly expandable through adding compression, and then once you reach your limitations on compression, doing something called looping, where you add additional segments of line in the areas where you have pressure constraints.
It's all coming back to me. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Stickle.
All right, moving on to slide 12. So slide 12 is going to be a similar chart, which shows annual state equity revenues and outlays with the 25% ownership scenario. And then I assume slide 13 is the zoom in again. Yeah, so slide 13 being the 5 years of capital outlays and then the first 5 years of positive revenue from the project, showing that with the 25% annual or 25% ownership, those capital outlays would be around $800 or a little higher million dollars per year for 2027 through 2029. And then, again, positive equity returns to the state beginning in 2031. And slide 14 some information around the state revenues at different throughput levels. This is one of the questions that we had from the previous meeting. So we, in our baseline modeling, we assume that the phase one in-state gas will receive a FID first, and that construction will begin and that pipeline will come on online, and then that the full AKLNG project will achieve a final investment decision sometime between when phase one is approved and when phase one comes online. So in our cost of supply numbers that we're presenting for the full project, we assume that the cost to Alaskans is averaged over the project. So when phase one comes online, that they will benefit from the fact that the full project is coming and pay a low cost of supply. That is an assumption. It's one way that the contracts could be worked out. And again, I know there's been a request for a phase one only analysis, and we will provide that. And so that is kind of the timeline assumption, is that there would be a phase one approval, that would produce in-state only for 2 years, and then that the full project would come online in three trains over 2031, 32, and 33, but that the cost to Alaskans would represent a levelized cost that incorporates the benefits of having the full project online.
Representative Sandler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on slide 14, some terminology here. The first bullet says you guys are assuming that the final investment decision and gas sale agreements are finalized. That mean gas sales agreements for phase two?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, very good. And so the assumption is that that will happen before deliveries commence. Okay, and that that's a lot of a strong assumption, because then those assumptions will bear under point two. Those will bear on the price for the gas in phase one. Is that correct?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, interesting. Okay. And again, what's the final investment decision timeline now? I guess I should ask Mr. Kissinger, remind me what the latest final investment decision target is.
Mr. Kissinger, did you hear the question?
This is Matt Kissinger, through the chair. Yes, I did. Chair Freer, thank you. Representative Sadler, through the chair, I would like to get out of putting these place marks on when we're going to achieve an FID, and just instead always talk about what it takes to achieve the FID and how we're progressing. So you take the upstream contracts. We now have sufficient gas for phase one already under contract with gas sale precedent agreements. Those need to be turned into full gas sales agreements. So that's being done as we speak. Next to that, you have the downstream gas sales agreements to the utility customers in Alaska. Those negotiations are ongoing and would be followed by an RCA filing, as our understanding, where the utilities would take their gas sales agreements to the RCA for approval. And those would need to be done in advance of a full FID. We'll need to enter into the final agreements with the EPCM, Worley, and with each of the construction contractors. All those initial agreements are done, but again, all need to be turned into definitive agreements. And then finally, we need to get the financing, the debt financing in place, so that we know what the equity requirement is. So all of those are progressing as we speak. They're progressing nicely. There are certain things that could make it happen very quickly, and there are other things that could make it be extended by a matter of months. When it comes to phase two, we're also simultaneously progressing that, and so we have either letters of intent or heads of agreement for 13 million tons per annum out of the total 20, and we're trying to achieve 16. So 13 out of 16 is where we sit now with respect to long-term commitments. Those letters of intent need to be turned into heads of agreement. That's when pricing happens. And then we do have one heads of agreement already done, and multiple others, I'd say, coming soon. Those would then need to be turned into what they're called definitive LNG sales and purchase agreements, LNG SPAs. And that would take several months, usually, to go from the heads of agreement to the final definitive agreements. With respect to the real key milestones, the real difficult things like pricing discussions, those are already done on the upstream gas, and those are already done on the downstream deliveries. So it is a matter of a lot more papering at this point, and then moving into the financing.
Good.
Follow up.
Thank you. And Mr.
I apologize for not giving you a direct date.
I appreciate that. In fact, I'd rather think that promising dates by a certain calendar date has been non-productive, but okay. Remind me, if you would, about the debt financing decisions. What is the precipitate? What is the starting gun for when the state I think I heard 6 months. So what's the precipitating event and the timeline in which the state must make a decision to avail itself of the opportunity to invest from 5 to 25% in the project? What are those timelines, please?
Representative Sadler through the chair. What would kick that off would be the equity raise. And so as I walked through all of those steps, the equity raise was the very last step. Every time that there's an equity raise, what mechanically will happen is 8-Star Alaska, the parent company joint venture that is 25% owned in perpetuity by AGDC, and our partner Glen Farm, we will divest of equity within the subproject. So take the pipeline subproject as the first one. We own 100% of 8-Star Pipeline LLC. We will begin divesting of equity in that in order to raise the capital. Every single time that happens, every time a party comes in and offers to provide that capital, we have the right to preempt it. So that would be FID. That would be that trigger, because that is when those commitments are made. Starting with that commitment, so starting with FID, we then have 6 months to determine whether we want to preempt that and back into it or not.
Thank you. I understand the financing the project by selling off equity or taking out debt. So after the FID, that will happen. And remind us again here, does that require legislative approval, or is that a decision made by AGDC?
I'm sorry, Representative Sadler, which decision do you mean?
The decision to invest in from 5% to 25%. The question I'm getting to, is that going to require a special legislative session at any time?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, obviously if it's an appropriation to AGDC in order to fund that investment, then yes, that would require the legislative action. If it was done through some other way, like, we are looking at ways to raise money or to offer this investment opportunity to all Alaskans. I think that was intent of Congress in the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act of 2004, and I think that's also uncodified law within the AGDC enabling statutes. And so if somehow we were able to raise these multiple billions through that mechanism, which is obviously not very likely, then we could just move forward. Or if we used revenue bonding authority that AGDC already has.
And I have to follow up on that too. Yeah, I don't think that there's enough disposable capital in people's piggy banks to invest in that, even if that opportunity is theoretically present. So actually, this brings up a question I wish I had asked earlier. Would AHFC, ADA, Alaska Railroad bond...
Excuse me, Rep. Sadler. Yes. We've had some questions in the queue for quite some time. Is there any way we can just put a pause and then you can come back? Sorry, Jerry. So we've been waiting.
I saw you, yeah. Representative Colomb, you were next, then Representative Fields. Sadly, I'll put you back in the queue.
Okay. So thank you, Chair. So this is actually to Mr. Stickle. I thought I understood what that bullet meant, and then there was an exchange with you and Rep. Sadler. Can you tell me, so I'm on slide 14, it says the cost of supply within those contracts represents a levelized cost of supply of natural gas over the model's tolling period. Can you explain that in a different way?
Sure. Again, Dan Stickle for the record, Representative Colomb through the chair. So the question that we were answered is what state revenues and cost of supply would look at different throughput levels. And so the way that we answered this is we looked at our modeling of the project over the years as the project comes online. Okay. And one way that prices to Alaskans could be set is that in the first year when there's low throughput, there would be a relatively higher price. Mm-hmm. And then as the project advances to full exports and there's additional throughput, so you're taking the cost of the project and dividing it over more throughput, that the cost to Alaskans would decline over time. So start out higher and end up lower. What we are doing in our modeling is we're assuming that there's a levelized cost to Alaskans, so that we look at the total expected throughput over the life of the project, the total cost, and we give them one One cost of service over the life of the project, which starts out much lower than it would other be otherwise be, and ends up a little bit higher than it would otherwise be. Okay. And so we just wanted to clarify that assumption, that the cost of service doesn't change over time based on the throughput levels in our baseline modeling.
Okay, that's that makes sense. All right, thank you.
Do you want to ask another question, Representative? No, I'm just kidding.
I don't need another
one. Representative Fields?
I was just going to express a request that we make it to slide 17, about which I have questions.
Okay. I agree, but I do have a question from Co-Chair Dibert before we get there.
Thank you to the Co-Chair, to Mr. Stickle. I'm going back to kind of bounce back off Representative Sadler's thoughts. When an equity position, can we make an equity position on only phase one, or do we have to do phase one and two? I don't know how that works.
Sure, Co-Chair Diber, and again, Matt Kissinger could provide additional detail, but my understanding is we can choose to invest in each of the three components. Mm-hmm. So we could choose to invest in the pipeline and not the gas treatment plant or liquefaction facility. We could also choose to take a different share of the pipeline or the liquefaction or the treatment plant.
Okay. Thank you. I might have another question on that, a follow-up. Thank you.
Okay. Before we let's get through the rest of the presentation, and then we'll stick with questions at the end.
All right, so slide 14 was meant as a prelude to slide 15, which is our bar chart showing state revenues over the life of the project broken out into the various components of state revenue, being the property tax, production tax, corporate income tax, royalties. These would be based on the current law before implementation of HB 381, but what this chart shows is the period of time at the very beginning there where we do have the phase one only, that the total revenue to the state is basically what this shows is that the significant positive revenues to the state do come once we have the full project online. And the next slide, slide 16, zooms in on those first several years of the project. So when we have the phase one only, the project is actually a net negative to the state due to reductions in production tax revenue. And this has to do with some of the expenditures that we're assuming that the upstream producers will make to expand those fields to supply gas ultimately for the project. And then once we have the first train online in 2031, there is a positive revenue to the state. And then once we get out to 2033, that reaches to about $1 billion per year of positive revenue. Again, these include the production tax or the property tax revenues to the state. And with HB 381 enacted, there's about a $230 million reduction to the production or to the property tax revenues, and so we'd be receiving about $800 million per year associated with the project.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. Also, so on slide 15 and slide 16, I just want to comment that you have corporate income tax on there, and obviously we know with this project and with 8-Star and Glen Farm being LLCs, I'm just curious what that is.
Sure, Co-Chair Freer. So in terms of our corporate income tax assumption, we do assume that the midstream operator is not subject to corporate income tax. What that corporate income tax represents is a portion of the upstream. So we assume that about two-thirds of the upstream producers are subject to corporate income tax. And so that would represent the impact on those producers. As we know, some companies are subject to corporate income tax and some are not.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. We are almost at slide 17, Representative Sadler.
Sure, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Proceed, please.
All right. And so slide 17 takes the information from the previous slide and puts dollars to it. Again, this is under the current law scenario, so before enactment of HB 381 with the property tax, but we show the total property tax, corporate income tax, oil and gas royalties, and oil and gas production tax impacts, as well as the at the bottom there, the total gas sales going through the project. Under this baseline analysis, the in-state cost of supply would be $4.86 to utilities, and then the delivered LNG cost of supply would be $9.07 into the market. And then again, with HB 381 layered on top of it, the property tax numbers, once the project is fully operational, would be a little over $200 million reduced. And then those cost of supply to in-state consumers, as well as the cost of supply into the market, would both be reduced as well.
I've got Representative Sadler, then Representative Fields. But can we try to leave it at one follow-up and then get back in the queue? Representative Sadler.
Real briefly. So I see state revenues at different throughput levels. Are we assuming that – I don't see any volumetric flow rates. Are you assuming that the flow levels will be increasing at a steady state? Or where is the different throughput levels reflected in this? I see dates but not volumes.
Sure, Representative Sadler, through the chair. So it's that bottom line, the total LNG plus gas sales. That would be the so the in-state gas sales are the 65 BC billion cubic feet per year, and then the remainder of that would be export gas.
Thank you,
Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Just confirming the foregone revenue in terms of upstream oil production tax minus 82, minus 82, minus 42, minus 24. Is because an upstream oil company could deduct their gas capital expenditures under this bill from their production tax owed to the state.
Representative Fields, through the chair, that's correct. So under the production tax statute, we levy a gross tax on gas production, but then we have a net tax on oil production, and all lease expenditures are allowed against that oil production tax. We also have detailed modeling that models out the impact of per taxable barrel credits, which are applied on a statewide basis after the segment specific calculations for oil and gas.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
All right, so then the last slide, I believe, is slide 18, and apologize for the fuzziness of the graphic here and the copy-paste, but this shows the total revenue from the alternative volumetric tax for each of the project components for both the state and the municipality. This was one of the requests from the committee. So we showed this, as I mentioned earlier, for any property within a municipality, the entirety of the volumetric tax goes to that municipality. So the state benefit from the alternative volumetric tax would be only the tax attributable to the share of the pipeline in the unorganized borough. All of the tax from the treatment plant would go to the North Slope borough. All of the tax from the LNG plant would go to the Kenai Peninsula borough. And then the other boroughs, all of the boroughs that the pipeline transits through would receive a portion of the alternative volumetric tax.
And I
believe that's my last slide.
We know everything there is to know about the gas line.
Are there thank you so much for your presentation. Are there we do have time for questions. Are there questions from the committee for Co-Chair Dibert?
Thank you, Co-Chair Freer, to Mr. Stickle. Thank you for your presentation. I have a lot to think on here after this presentation. Just looking at this, I know the pipeline goes only 2 miles through Fairbanks, but we're having to do that like 90% tax cut, and I think we won't see like money in return until like 2030 three possibly. But to build the pipeline, it takes workers, houses. It's going through Goldstream Valley, wear and tear on roads, and then to not see any dollars until then, that's going to be a hit to our community. And then you can see the numbers here, one, and then two for Fairbanks. So I don't know. There's really not a question, but I guess how many people are required to build this? Is there a number discussed? Thank you.
Sure, Co-Chair Dybert. I don't have that off the top of my head. That might be a question for the developer, or perhaps for Mr. Kissinger.
Kissinger.
I think I can answer that question. In a previous presentation, I can't remember if it was from Mr. Kissinger or it was Mr. Prestige with Glenfarn. They had indicated that they would need about 7,000 workers to complete the project. If I remember correctly, Mr. Kissinger, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, Chip Faria, that's my recollection too, is it's around 7,000. This is a number that's under refinement, but that's in the ballpark.
Thank you. Representative Souther?
Thank you. Mr. Kissinger, we've been hanging fire on the any agreement with the mayors of the affected municipalities and with every kind of agreement, which we're calling for shorthand a project labor agreement, a PLA, with labor organizations. Can you give us an update on where those negotiations stand and when might we expect some agreements and confirmation of those things?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, all I can say is that they're ongoing. They're discussions happening today. They're with the mayors. There was heavy discussions happening yesterday on project labor. Our hope, obviously, is to reach agreement as soon as possible. So,
follow up.
Thank you. I appreciate that ongoing. But as in any negotiation, the first person to offer the first is often at a disadvantage. What we have before us is legislation that essentially puts out the state's financial terms. So we will be the first one to make an offer. And I think that does put us at a disadvantage. I'm looking forward eagerly to news about the PLA and municipal impact aid agreements before we pass this legislation.
Thank you, Representative Souther. I echo your sentiment. I guess add on to some of the conversation from my co-chair. You know, we look at this a project like this, and I said this before. You know, I would love to have a pipeline and or a gas line, and see energy costs go down for all Alaskans. But I think it sets a precedent, and you know, we're doing a lot of work offline as well to communicate with our communities and constituents and friends. I look forward to seeing some of the amendments that come through. I know we're having discussions about the amendments. We did extend the amendment deadline until Friday at 4:30. So I'm looking forward to continuing the discussion on or offline. And I thank you, Mr. Stickle, for coming back. I know that we had to cancel four resources committee meetings in a row and we have another, but I appreciate that you're here in Juneau and that you're available to answer questions and want to thank you and Amy as well for getting us the documentation so that we can have a look at it prior to this committee. And we had extra time to review it before we actually got the presentation. Are there any other questions or comments from committee members at this time?
Go ahead.
All right. Representative Elam, Representative Colomb, then Representative Dybert.
Thank you. Not sure, you know what I mean, and maybe I can follow up with some of this offline. But one of the things I'd be really interested in seeing is what the economic impacts are going to be on the state from the private perspective rather than just from the government revenues perspective. What kind of actual economic impacts are we going to be looking at from energy and from industry building, you know, jobs that are created. I know there's, we've had a variety of conversations, but it would be nice to see what some of those ancillary impacts might be outside of just how does it fund government.
Absolutely. Representative Klump?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I just a comment and quick question, but thank you so much for letting this kind of free flow. It was really helpful, mm-hmm. and I want to really appreciate Dan Stickle for coming here and answering our thousands of questions over and over. I really appreciate your patience with us. My last question to you is on slide 17. If we don't build a pipeline, would all those numbers be zero?
Representative Cologne, through the chair, yes.
Okay.
This represents incremental revenue compared to the official forecast.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further? Oh, sorry, Co-Chair Dibert.
Yeah, thank you to the co-chair, Mr. Stickle. I remembered my question from earlier. It was on the equity decision. I have on my notes here FID 6 months after FID, and I think my question is, when will we have to decide that? Was it, can you just go through that again? Is it after?
Sure. Co-Chair Dibert, and that would be, you know, Matt Kissinger can explain a little bit more. I think the statement was that the equity investment decision would be 6 months after the FID on that portion of the project.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I wanted to finish my question about state participation. The question I want to come up against is, where does the state come up with 5 or 25% equity in any of the three elements? We don't have a whole bunch of money sitting around using for that. So my question is, could we borrow money using bonding authority from AHFC or ADA or the Alaska Railroad or AGDC's bonding authority to provide that 5 to 25% equity? I guess that's more Mr. Kissinger.
Mr. Kissinger.
This is Matt Kissinger through the chair, Representative Sadler. We are exploring ways to use revenue bonds. There are the railroad bonds, as you mentioned, and AGDC also have the authority to issue revenue bonds. Just so it's clear, these are bonds that are not backed by the full faith and credit of the state of Alaska. These are just backed by the revenues that they're matched to. The issue with that is the depth of the municipal bonding market. We've had conversations with advisors on that, and we're right now trying to get an understanding of how big that market could be. But, you know, several billion dollars could potentially stress that market.
Right. And I understand the follow-up.
That's just a limitation that we want to identify. Yeah.
That's the beauty of a project financing model, is that we're not pledging the permanent fund or the state's full faith and credit, but we do have a significant bonding capacity. So I really am glad to hear that. And we'll ask more about that later. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any further questions from committee members? Seeing none, we will absolutely take this bill up again. Hopefully in a future hearing, we'll finally have the presentation from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power and the Institute of Social and Economic Research. I anticipate more hearings, hopefully with you, Mr. Stickle, as well as AGDC, Glenn Farn, Mr. Begich, and other folks to consider some of the proposals that people are putting together. But with that, that completes the agenda for our House Resources Committee meeting today. Our next House Resources Committee meeting is on Friday, April 17th, when the committee will have House Bill 381 back before the committee, as well as House Bill 321 to consider amendments or a possible CS. The time now is 2:46 p.m., and this hearing of the House Resources Committee is now 2:46 p.m., and this hearing of the House Resources Committee is now adjourned.